there's a lot of work being done in the state, but there's just not a lot of technologies that are ready to be put in the water.
The promise and limitations of using tides to power communities across Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 30th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Bethel prepares for the annual Chamay Festival and the powerful moment called the Heart of the Drums.
It's usually a very powerful time of Chamay where everybody participates.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The Senate has voted to let states block federal family planning money from going to Planned Parenthood affiliates and other abortion providers. Senators approved the Republican legislation 51-50. Vice President Mike Pence cast the tie-breaking vote after two GOP senators, Maine's Susan Collins and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, voted with Democrats against the measure. The bill erases a regulation imposed by former President Barack Obama that lets states deny family planning funds to an organization only if it's incapable of providing those services. Some states have passed laws in recent years denying the funds to groups that provide abortions. Democrats criticized the measure as an attack on women's rights and abortion. Republicans defended it as a way to let local officials decide where family planning money should go. 150 years ago today, the United States signed a treaty and bought Alaska from Russia. Or, since many Alaskans dispute the land was owned by either country, bought Russia's claim on Alaska. In Washington, D.C., the occasion's being marked with a ceremony at the State Department and a concert at the National Archives. Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin wondered if the treaty that shaped modern Alaska left any mark on the city where it was signed. Here's what she found.
Washington is a city of national monuments, none of which honors William Seward. There's no marker on the spot where the Secretary of State signed the purchase treaty with Russia. A few miles away, near the Capitol, there is a Seward Square. It's not easily recognized, even when you're standing on it.
Do you know where Seward Square is?
Yeah, this Seward is Square.
The square is crisscrossed by streets, creating a collection of grassy patches cut up by 8 lanes of traffic.
Yeah, I don't know what the traffic island is, but, you know, this little block here.
So that's the square.
Is that the same? I mean, I sort of always thought of it as, like, these little blocks. Here, there, there, and there. Kind
Wait.
Of make a square.
Thank you.
Let's leave this so-called Seward Square. Walk a few blocks to the Capitol and go inside. And then you go down this hallway, go all the way to the end, right by the elevator, and look up.
There it is on the ceiling, a vaulted ceiling. It's an artist's rendition of the map of Alaska, and it says Alaska Purchase, 1867.
It turns out there's a reason this mural is at the very end of the hallway.
Well, I would describe it as a figurative style.
Michelle Cohen is the curator in the Office of the Architect of the Capitol. She says the Alaska mural was painted by artist Jeffrey Green, but he had several constraints.
He's trying to be very consistent with the style that defines Alan Cox's work, which is what would be called sort of an academic figurative style.
Alan Cox was the artist first hired to decorate this side of the Capitol. He planned a series of murals depicting the nation's history. Cohen says Cox wanted his halls to fit in with the 19th century murals elsewhere in the building. The Cox murals look something like old botanical illustrations or Audubon prints, but showing people and places rather than plants and birds.
So we're standing in one of the corridors that constitute really the Cox corridors, and it's known as the Western Expansion Corridor.
Cohen points out that the murals are chronological. Exploration, Daniel Boone, the Louisiana Purchase, and at the very end, the acquisitions of Alaska and Hawaii. Cox, though, died before he could paint this corridor. Years later, Green took it on. Only by then it was the 1990s, and ideas about Western expansion and manifest destiny had evolved. Cohen says Green wanted his work to reflect the understanding that the West wasn't empty before the settlers arrived.
He thought about the iconography and the content that was part of the original design, and he wanted to make it a more inclusive mural, and I think a more nuanced historical narrative about Western expansion.
It's subtle, but it's there. Green painted Lewis and Clark gazing out over a Native American village rather than untrammeled wilderness. For Alaska, Green added a person in a kayak to the map. The guy's boat is nearly as large as the Aleutian chain. Green also included the names of Alaska towns and cities. As the curator tells it, that's how the artist met the challenge of honoring 19th century concepts from a modern perspective on history. Happy Alaska Purchase Day from Washington, D.C. I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Naknek Electrical Association has filed a lawsuit against its former longtime manager, Donna Vukic, seeking $1 million in damages. NEA alleges that Vukic used the company credit card for personal expenses going back more than a decade, and that she's no longer cooperating to pay back the embezzled funds. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
A forensic audit of NEA's books between 2004 and 2016 shows former manager Donna Vukic spent $970,358 for personal expenses on the company credit card. NEA board president Nancy Morris Lyons says Vukic was the only employee with oversight of that spending and that she coded it all to NEA business accounts to hide the trail.
For instance, if there was a large purchase of, say, $2,000 made that was for personal use, say $500 would go to operating costs and another $500 would go to waste heat. And so it would be hidden and buried within the company and nobody would ever see anything other than, you know, the coded items that went in there.
The spending spree increased as the years went by. Looking backwards over the books, the NEA board decided that the embezzling trickled down enough by 2004 that it was no longer worth further auditing. Vukic was the general manager for 18 total years and an employee of the utility cooperative for 3 decades before she retired in March 2016. Morris Lyons says the scheme used by Vukic to embezzle the money was simple but ingenious.
From the management level down, the only person that was seeing or knowing that that money was not spent on the things it was being coded for was the manager herself. So it was, I've always said I want people to learn from this and hopefully save others from the same predicament.
Confronted last year with an initial accounting, Vukic paid back $398,000. That was on top of a little over $19,000 she paid back to the company account in 2014 when she was still the manager. NEA says negotiations to recoup the remaining $553,000 have fallen apart. After a year had passed and some $60,000 spent in auditing and attorney fees, the board took the matter to court, suing Vukic for a total of $1 million in punitive damages.
We decided in order to make sure that we were going to be legal and keep our members safe, we needed to go ahead and make the filing happen. And, you know, we will continue to try and recoup all funds for the co-op.
The case was filed in Anchorage Superior Court and assigned to Judge Andrew Guidi. Vukic is represented by Anchorage attorney Brian Heddy, who did not respond to phone calls or email requests for comment this week. Vukic was a longtime member of the Naknek community, a friend to many, and a trusted manager of the electric co-op until towards the end of her career when an expensive geothermal endeavor she led folded. Morris Lyons says it was initially difficult for the board and the members to accept the magnitude of her theft, and it's still hard to accept the indifference she has displayed about it.
We're brokenhearted, but we're also indignant at the fact that we could have been played like this, basically, I guess is the best way to put it. But it's terrible to see one of your own, you know, having abused the system so tragically. So, yeah, it's still a mixture of feelings. It's still very emotional, but it's constantly said in the boardroom that we need to look out for the best for our members.
NEA's audit was turned over to the Bristol Bay Borough Police Department, which has requested the assistance of the FBI. Borough Police Chief Stan Swetsoff says both state and federal prosecutors are aware of the investigation, which could result in criminal charges in addition to the civil lawsuit filed by NEA. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Immigration authorities say agents rounded up 84 people, including 60 with criminal records, during a three-day operation in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. Four of those picked up in Anchorage on administrative but not criminal charges. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says the operation ended Monday, targeted criminals residing in the U.S. illegally. Those arrested included 77 men and 7 women from 12 countries, the vast majority of them from Mexico. Some will be prosecuted for illegally reentering the country, while the rest will face deportation proceedings. As for the four arrested in Anchorage, an ICE spokeswoman did not return calls or an email seeking comment, including the names of the alleged offenders or the administrative charges they face. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska was not aware of the arrests as of Thursday. Spokeswoman says the four were apparently not charged in criminal court. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a hometown skier is crowned national champion in the state in the skate sprint in Fairbanks.
Dreaming and thinking about this one for a very long time, and so to have it actually come true on the home course is just, it's unbelievable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The municipality of Anchorage is partnering with a private foundation to fund a new position that'll be in charge of overseeing housing issues. At a press conference held at City Hall today, Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz announced the new chief housing officer position will be funded through a 2-year, $400,000 grant from the Rasmussen Foundation. There is no cost to the city budget. The position will be filled by Robin Ward, the current director of the city's real estate department. In a release from the administration, the housing officer is described as a liaison between the municipality and the development community with the aim of boosting residential housing stock through initiatives, incentives, and new strategies. Developers and contractors have long been critical of the municipality's building requirements, pointing to the Title 21 code as a major impediment to new construction in the city's relatively tight housing market. As of a 2012 report by the McDowell Group says Anchorage needs about 900 new units per year to keep up with demand. Currently, the city issues between 300 and 400 permits a year, according to a spokesman with the administration. When you think about renewable energy in Alaska, what comes to mind? Probably wind, which contributes about 3% of the state's power generation, and maybe solar panels, which are starting to gain a little bit of momentum. But there's also the potential for what lies along 6,500 miles of coastline. An Ask the Energy Desk listener wanted to know, why isn't Alaska using more wave or tidal energy? Reporter Elizabeth Jenkins found the answer.
I think the highest wave we measured when we were there was, it was on the order of 20 feet.
That's Jeremy Casper speaking about the coastline of Yakutat. Those gnarly waves make the Southeast Village a good spot to surf, but that's not the reason Casper has gone there in the past. He's part of a team at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, studying the feasibility of generating power from the movement of the water.
You know, I think this is a worthwhile technology because it basically fills in a niche.
A niche that can't be filled by hydropower dams. Yakutat is home to about 600 people, and it's powered using a diesel generator. Casper says the village's geography and weather patterns make other types of renewable energy a challenge. He thinks solar could work in the summer when there's increased demand for energy and the fish plants in operation. But when it comes to displacing Yakutat's diesel fuel for the rest of the year,
wave is probably their best option.
In 2009, a study by the Electric Power Research Institute backed that up. It was funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. And it estimated that for under $1 million, Yakutat could install one wave energy converter. For reference, it would take about 15 of those to supply half of Yakutat's energy needs. Casper says the village has completed a number of the early studies for its federal permitting. Still, there's no planned timeline for an installation yet.
So there's a lot of work being done in the state, but there's just not a lot of technologies that are ready to be put in the water.
Part of the reason wave or tidal energy carries such a steep price tag is because the technology is so new. With wind or solar energy, there's an established chain of supply and demand, decades of upgrades and improvements,
and the ability to mass manufacture.
That's Chris Rose, the director of the nonprofit Renewable Energy Alaska Project. On its website, the organization refers to the potential of wave and tidal energy as, quote, a gold mine, albeit one that needs more time and investment.
So right now, what you have with tidal energy and wave energy and even in-river hydrokinetics is the developers who are still trying to perfect their design before they go out and make 10,000 of them.
Yakutat isn't the only place in Alaska looking at this type of renewable energy. In 2014, a company based in Maine successfully generated a small amount of power from the current of a river near the village of Igiagig. And that same company has explored using Cook Inlet's massive tides as an energy source. Although there's still more work to be done to measure the impacts on marine life, like endangered beluga whales. Jeremy Casper says the impact on fish is also something Yakutat needs to cross off its list before seriously considering wave energy. But he doesn't think the development of the technology is too far off.
They could conceivably be in the water in a couple years. So, and getting to that point, though, is a matter of figuring out how to pay for those installations.
In the meantime, he'll go back to Yakutat in May to do another study. And possibly, he says, try to catch some waves. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska Airlines executives say the integration of former rival Virgin America is proceeding on track. Parent company Alaska Air Group updated Wall Street analysts on the merger at an Investor Day briefing in New York City Wednesday. One thing left up in the air was how long Alaska will keep Virgin America's Airbus fleet. Chief Financial Officer Brandon Pedersen noted Alaska Airlines operated an all-Boeing fleet for decades until last year.
Regardless of the decision that we make, Airbus airplanes will be with us for a long time because it would be extraordinarily expensive to return those airplanes early. We need the lift. We're going to be an Airbus customer for the foreseeable future.
Pedersen says most of the 68 Airbus jets in Virgin's fleet this year are on leases that run through at least 2021. He says Alaska Air will announce a decision by the end of this year whether to remain a mixed fleet operator long term or go back to an all-Boeing fleet. Last week, Seattle-based Alaska announced it will retire the Virgin America brand and repaint those planes likely sometime next year. The combined airline's top brass added that it will standardize the first-class cabins, resulting in plusher seats with more legroom than Alaska currently offers. But it'll be less space than Virgin's current first-class offering. Alaska Air Group CEO Brad Tilden said his team evaluated whether to offer lie-flat seats on transcontinental flights to keep pace with larger competitors, but decided that ultimately it wasn't worth it. Alaska is projected to owe public workers more than $6 billion more in pensions than it has in assets. So state officials are looking for ways to save money. They plan to sell $2 to $3 billion in bonds last fall, but Walker paused the effort after some Senate Finance Committee members expressed concern that the bonds would be too risky. Committee co-chair Anna McKinnon of Eagle River worked with Walker's office to craft a bill she sees as a compromise on how to handle bond sales when the legislature isn't in session.
From my perspective, the legislature responded and felt a bit flat-footed without a process that was established.
By law, Governor Walker has the ability to issue up to $5 billion in bonds to pay for public employee pensions. McKinnon has written a bill that would cut Walker's pension bond authority in half to $2.5 billion. It also gives the legislature more oversight authority by requiring the administration to give the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee 45 days to weigh in on the sale.
In no way am I advocating that this is endorsement for issuing pension obligation bonds. But in working with the governor's office, this strikes a balance.
The bonds are essentially low-interest debt. The state would use that money to invest. If investment returns are higher than the bond's rate, then the state would save money. McKinnon notes that if the state had issued the bonds last fall, it would have saved money so far.
Just to underscore, Alaska would have received a positive number. We would owe less in our unfunded liability.
McKinnon introduced the measure, Senate Bill 97, but plans to reintroduce it Friday with the entire Senate Finance Committee sponsoring it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Tis the season for specialty crop grant applications. The grants are part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's effort to expand certain crops and are distributed by the State Division of Agriculture. Johanna Herron with the Division of Agriculture says farmers of root vegetables, fruits, and even flowers are eligible to apply.
The industry we see the most applying for proposals for the specialty crop is the peony industry, and that's the flower industry. They've been kind of blossoming to put a pun out there just over the last few years and growing as a sector.
Herron says the division awards a total of about $200,000 each year. Letters of intent to apply for specialty crop grants are due Friday. The Super Tour Spring Series cross-country ski races continued in Fairbanks last night with national championship skate technique sprints. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a local skier took gold.
Logan Hahnemann claimed the top spot in the men's 1.6-kilometer skate technique sprint, winning a national championship on his hometown trails at Fairbanks Birch Hill Recreation Area. The 24-year-old Hahnemann says he's been focused on the skate sprint since the United States Ski Association announced a year ago that season-ending championships would be held in Fairbanks.
Dreaming and thinking about this one for a very long time, and so to have it actually come true on the home course is just, it's unbelievable.
Hahnemann ran strong through qualification, quarter, semi, and final rounds, where he says he used local experience to ski the course to his advantage.
Growing up all through high school and everything, I knew that we always used to practice sprints down the stadium hill and across the flat part of the stadium, over speeds, you know. And since the sprint course does that same course, I knew that that's something I would be strong at. So then for the semifinal and the final, I was relaxed on the first hill and I knew that I could make some passes across the flat to go into the last hill.
That's where Hahnemann pulled away in the final, igniting the crowd as he skied powerfully to the front and across the line to clear victory.
That's amazing, ladies and gentlemen.
A multi-time junior national champion, it was Hahnemann's first U.S. title as a senior skier. He was followed across the line by Canada's Evan Palmer-Charette in second and two-time past national sprint champ Tyler Cornfield of Anchorage in third. In the women's 1.5-kilometer sprint, Minnesota's Jessie Diggins and Anchorage's Keegan Randall repeated the 1-2 finish the pair posted in Monday's opening race at Birch Hill, but third place in Wednesday's sprint was a surprise, with Montana's Erica Flowers stepping up to grab her first-ever national championship medal.
Well, I've made a couple finals at nationals and always finished sixth, so I was like, okay, today I'm not going to finish sixth. So that was my goal, and I was like, you know, today, why not today?
National championship races continue Friday night at Birch Hill with relays and wrap up Sunday with marathons. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The 2017 Chamai Dance Festival begins tomorrow at the Bethel Regional High School. The weekend-long cultural celebration marks the largest annual gathering of Alaska Native dance in the world. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur sat down with the organizers and has this report.
This year's theme, the Nunanriyum Natlini, meaning during the time of joy.
Peter Achek has been helping organize Chamai for more than a decade.
It's the opposite of mourning. Chamai is a celebration.
Along with the pioneering Alaska Greenland band Bamiwa, there will also be regional groups performing from places like Alakanuk, Chivak, and Mountain Village. Soon after the festival begins Friday evening, Chamai will honor Raphael and Vivian Jimmy of Mountain Village as living treasures. Peter Achek says the honor is a way for the community to say thank you to the cultural bearers who've kept Yupik dancing alive.
Raphael and Vivian represent the age that many of us we didn't see during the time when Western civilization have not affected or have not come into to our area yet, and they have retained a lot of what used to be, you know, the traditional type of dancing, and they practice that with their group now, and they just carry on the tradition like it was before any before any touch from the Western civilization or anywhere else in the world.
The following day of the festival, Saturday, a tradition is being revived after more than a decade, the fur fashion show. Linda Curta got the idea after the University of Alaska Fairbanks Kuskokwim University campus started a fur parka sewing class and students asked to share their work.
And I said, we can't just share it. We have to create the fur fashion show again. And so, yes, it's been since 2005.
Curta calls the show a parade of history, tradition, and skill. Next up is Peter Achek's favorite moment of the weekend, the heart of the drums, when all the drummers at the festival climbed to the top of the bleachers in the Bethel Regional High School gym, circling the audience and begin to beat in unison.
It's usually a very powerful time of Jamai where everybody participates.
I do believe that as that drum is beating and the song is being sung, that all of our hearts truly get in unison. Your bodies just share with one another, and we all become sort of the drum ourselves.
We've had people come up to us afterwards, you know, and say that, wow, you know, I didn't expect that. Some of them come with their daily challenges and they're heavy laden, and then I no longer feel like that. I no longer feel so heavy laden. Some healing happened during the heart of the drums.
Also on Saturday are free dental screenings from the Yukon Kuskokwim Dental Clinic, a workshop on Yupik regalia, and the native foods dinner. Throughout it all, they'll be dancing, beginning Friday evening and stretching over 3 days of celebration, remembrance, and culture into Sunday night. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We have reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Casey Grove in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our editor tonight was Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.